Raise your hand if you want your nails to look perfect all the time. Me too. I'm Sarah Gibson Tuttle from Olive & June, and this is exactly why we created the Manny system. We wanted to make it possible for everyone everywhere to give themselves a beautiful manicure at home. With our tools and our long-lasting polish, each manicure with our Manny system comes out to just $2. That's right, $2. No more $30, $40, $50 manis that you get at a salon and they take hours. Now you can paint your nails on your time and love them more than ever. And by the way, when people ask, who did your nails? Where did you get them done? You're going to proudly say, I did them myself. Get 20% off your first Manny system with code DIYNAIL20 at oliveandjune.com/DIYNAIL20. That's code DIYNAIL20 for 20% off at oliveandjune.com/DIYNAIL20.
New year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. So now get two snack wraps plus fries and a medium soft drink for just $8.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
Hi folks, welcome to episode 96 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined by Bo, and today we're going to be talking about William Wilberforce. How's that significant, Bo? How's William Wilberforce gone down in history?
Well, he's famed...
No particular interest, really, I'm sure.
He's famed for being one of the leading lights in the abolitionist movement, which we don't hear a lot about.
Weird, that, isn't it?
We get clubbed over the head with people like Edward Colston, but there's never usually like a Wilberforce week on Channel 4 or anything, is there?
Yeah, that is weird, isn't it?
We're not usually told about Wilberforce anymore. We used to. He used to be a national hero.
And then the more diversified Britain became, the less he became a national hero.
Mm. Yeah, you never hear about him really, do you?
No.
Anymore. No. Even when I was younger, in the 80s and 90s, you would sometimes, but not anymore.
I don't ever recall William Wilberforce being brought up when I was a kid, I have to say. You know, it was a few years ago that I looked into the abolition of slavery. And obviously, then I read about his life and the court case. But I don't recall hearing it at school.
Mm. Well, no, not at school, no.
That's right. But you'd think every school child would know who William Wilberforce was.
Well, he used to be. When he died, there was sort of some sort of national mourning, like when Nelson died. Like, everyone was upset. Mm. He was some sort of hero. Mm. In fact, Lincoln, there's a quote from Lincoln saying, every schoolboy is familiar with Wilberforce.
Well, it probably was in Lincoln's day.
In the 19th century, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But
no, we're not encouraged to remember the abolitionist movement, the British abolitionist movement anymore.
Well, I think there's a few reasons for that. It was very Christian.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to give the Christians any credit.
No, full credit to them.
Yeah.
Because this is absolutely born out of sort of a Christian morality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And no one wants to give them like that win. And it's like, well, they deserve it. If it wasn't for Christian charity, this probably wouldn't be the case.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'm not a Christian, but I'm sort of Christian adjacent, if you like.
I'm definitely sympathetic to Christians.
Yeah, right, yeah. So, if I'm at the pearly gates and they say, you've got to choose one.
Yeah.
Well, of course I say that, yeah. So Wilberforce has been called the conscience of the nation. Mm. Because he did really sort of over decades change what he called manners, but what we would just call morals. Mm. In the late 18th century, morals, manners were a lot more coarse. Life was a lot cheaper. Mm. And by the Victorian age, as he dies in 1833, it's a lot more humane, I think it's fair to say.
I would suggest that it's a dramatic improvement to what had come before. Mm. I mean, one of the things I quite like about the Victorians is the austere moralizing of them. Mm. It's a particular moral code that they follow as well, which I find interesting. You know, it's not abstract, right? It seems like quite real. You know, and it's for real things. You know, it's for lords and ladies and men and women. And, you know, the propriety is the thing that they're being dogmatically moral about rather than an abstract code. And so I find Victorian moralizing quite different to modern moralizing, which is very abstract about categories, you know. Mm. Like, but anyway, so
they were looking for like the betterment of all.
Mm.
Wilberforce and others talked about sort of the better hour, bringing about a better hour for people.
But it was a kind of moralizing that wasn't revolutionary, right? It was situated within the civilization.
Mm-hmm,
you know, it didn't hate its own civilization.
Right, yeah.
And in fact, it was like, okay, well, actually, we can do something great here, you know, which is why I find it kind of appealing. You know, I guess I'm just tired of people trying to overthrow our civilization.
Yeah. No, they wanted to build upon what they already had and make it better.
Yeah.
Reduce the suffering of people where possible. Because Wilberforce didn't just campaign just for abolitionism and emancipation, but also loads of other things.
Right, okay.
You know, like helping out orphans and all sorts of things.
Oh, that's great.
Loads of different things, yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to abolish poverty and things, all sorts of stuff.
Okay.
he was, and living in the late 18th century, early 19th century, he was a contemporary of some great people, loads of great people, among them Burke. He was a Member of Parliament, Wilberforce, as was Burke. And the famous line of Burke, "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing," may well come from, or it's all part of the Wilberforce story, because William Wilberforce is a great example of one man against the odds, at least to begin with, one man making a difference, realizing that he was facing a mountainous challenge on his own, almost on his own.
Massive entrenched financial interests.
Right. So that's the thing to say then about slavery straight away, is that it was something like, you could make some sort of equivalency with something like maybe the arms trade today, where there's giant vested interests, giant amounts of money on the line, whole swathes of society and jobs and all sorts of things, and industry all bound up in it, all wanting it to keep going. And then there's just the moral objection to it.
Well, one thing I think is interesting is the slave trade and the empire generally was kind of outside of the control of the government in many ways. Like, it happened far away, and it happened because of independent people being entrepreneurial, right? You know, explorers go to Africa, they find Africans selling other Africans, and they're, okay, well, we could take them to use them on private plantations in the Americas. You know, so it's kind of, it's something that has been done, I don't want to say organically, but you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't some great plot that the British Empire was like, ha ha, now we can create the largest slave trade in the world. You know, it was something that kind of grew up, right?
Well, to begin with, yeah, its roots were like that,
But, and then, of course, it gets kind of codified. But
just like the East India Company, by the late 18th century, early 19th century, Parliament had passed acts that, so they sort of formally controlled things,
Like you were saying, by the time of the 19th century, it's a massive industry, and there are tens of thousands of jobs involved in it. You know, huge livelihoods, fortunes have been made. So it is a massive industry that grows up. And then, you've got this one guy being like, but it is terrible.
Like a moral sin, a national disgrace. So that's one of the things I want to say, where in our day, people just try and make the argument that Britain is somehow ultimately guilty and got the stain of the crimes of our ancestors. Well, on some level, as every people and nation, but don't get any sort of credit for the abolitionist thing, which was, there were so many sort of good people, a grassroots movement, and there's still slavery in the world today.
Well, this is another thing that really annoys me. It's the... I recall reading on, I think it was Parliament's website, actually, about a petition that a 30,000-person signed petition, which is a lot in the 19th century, that the women of England had stitched together, and it was like 3 miles long, and then delivered it to Parliament, demanding on Christian grounds the abolition of slavery.
Yeah,
and no one talks about it.
They would have massive petition drives where the ordinary working-class people that lived in penury themselves, of Liverpool, of London, of Bristol, would sign in their droves saying, we're against this. We would love Parliament to abolish it.
Yeah. And no one talks about it.
So where's the equivalent of that in Nigeria? Oh, they've still got slavery in Nigeria today. Oh, that's interesting. In yeah, let's have a quick look at the list of countries where the most... India, China, North Korea, maybe obviously, Nigeria, Iran, Indonesia, Congo, Philippines, Afghanistan. Millions of slaves today in all those countries.
The only people who have to take accountability for their slavery are those people who are morally susceptible to be... to listen to the arguments against slavery. Because, I mean, a lot of these countries simply don't find a problem with it.
Right, yeah.
We find a problem with it. And so we can be beaten with that stick. So we're like, yeah, no, we agree. We've conceded the moral argument that slavery is wrong. And we did something about it. But, of course, a reasonable person would let it lie there. But, of course, if you're not a reasonable person, you're just trying to beat us with a stick. Well, you've got the perfect one.
If any... If any Indian, someone from the Indian subcontinent or sub-Saharan African tries to play the moral higher ground with Brits about slavery, it's absolute disgusting nonsense.
Did you see the clip of a Tunisian man going around recently?
No.
Right, well, he was being interviewed by a Tunisian journalist, and the Tunisian man was saying, well, look, we don't like the sub-Saharan Africans here because they have different moral values to us, and, you know, they should be deported back.
Oh, so Tunisian, so was he sort of Berber or something?
Yeah. He was North African. Right.
Not sub-Saharan African. Okay,
yeah. I see. So he's like, you know, Mediterranean looking.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, we should deport them back to sub-Saharan Africa. And the journalist, who is also North African, says, well, have you ever met any of the sub-Saharan Africans? And he's like, have I ever met them? My grandfather used to sell them. And it's like, okay, all right then. I mean,
it's funny, isn't it? Also, Arabic people, trying to have the high ground.
Oh, they've got no
absolute nonsense. I always mention Lawrence of Arabia, don't I? I can't help it.
Yeah.
There's some famous pictures of Lawrence at the 1919 Versailles conference with Faisal, Faisal the First. Faisal al-Hussein, al-Hashemi, and he's got a giant Sudanese slave with him in the early 20th century.
Well, Saudi Arabia didn't ban slavery until 1963.
Right.
1963. We had jet aircraft at that point. Television. And slaves.
Elvis.
Yeah.
Right. The Beatles. I mean, it's,
it's madness. So...
I'm going to put up that picture of Faisal with his giant Sudanese slave.
Fascinating, you know. Why not? But yeah, so anyway, we don't take lectures about slavery from other people.
Yeah, we should not. We absolutely should not.
I don't.
And if anyone says anything about it, just bring up the name, just intone the name Wilberforce.
Yeah.
One historian said, Wilberforce shows us that everyone... Not someone said, Archbishop Desmond Tutu said, Wilberforce shows us that everyone can make a difference. Few of us will be in Parliament as Wilberforce was, but all of us are part of community. All of us can find ways to serve others and bring about the good society.
Again, you can't help but feel that in the light of history, the attitude towards slavery being a moral wrong is kind of located only in Christianity.
Mm.
I can't. I mean, the progressives will say, "Well, what about us? We're secular." It's like, yeah, but your secular worldview is informed by the Christian roots that it was built upon. So you didn't come to this in isolation.
Yeah,
and other cultures around the world haven't come to this at all.
It was definitely born out of Wilberforce's Christian worldview as well.
I remember seeing Benjamin Franklin's letter to. I can't remember, you know, the president or whatever. He was arguing on Christian grounds that slavery should be abolished because we're all children of God. Mm. And it was explicitly Christian argument he was making. And it's like, okay, where do you see that in other cultures around the world? And the answer is you just don't.
Mm.
What you see is the British Navy coming up and forcing them to stop slaving.
Yeah, because that's after this period, which we won't be talking about in this epoch particularly. Mm. Yeah, The British Navy, the Royal Navy went around the world, or certainly in the Atlantic world, forcing other people to stop slave
trading. In the first half of the 19th slaves. Century, that's what we did. We abolished the West Africa trade. In the second half, we abolished the Arabian slave trade. So we, because I did a video about
tried
this.
To.
Yeah, well, tried to, yeah. I mean, for a period of time we did, but like, of course, when we're not in charge anymore and we are not patrolling all of these oceans, well, they'll do what they want. But yeah, so like by the middle of the 19th century, the anti-slavery movement was kind of flagging a bit. It was like, well, okay, we've done a lot of good work. And there's like, oh, but the Arabs are trading this. This is brilliant. You know, that's great. We've got a new crusade to go and fight. And so they did.
We did an epoch on Gordon of Khartoum, didn't we? And even then, in the very late 19th century, we're still trying to make the East Africans and the Arabs stop doing slavery.
They've been doing it for over 1,000 years.
Well, as I say, Faisal still had legally had Sudanese slaves in the 1920s.
They've been doing it since at least the 8th century. So,
oh, yeah, all right.
You
know,
it's the most ancient tradition they have, pretty much.
One of the United States' first foreign adventures was on the Barbary Coast in North Africa to stop slavery.
Yeah. It's just one of the things that the foreigners do.
Yeah. But Edward Colston, though.
Yeah.
But some of our country homes were paid for with plantation money from Barbados, though. So we're guilty. We must be forever guilty, stained by that, apparently. William Wilberforce wasn't sort of born and raised as a Christian, though. Well, as he was, but not as a hardline, moralising type Christian. Mm. He was sort of from a fairly well-to-do family, went to Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And apparently there he was what you might call a great swell, just a fun guy having parties and dinner parties. Right, apparently he was very eloquent and witty and quick, but wasn't a moraliser, nothing like that. He was up for having fun.
Right.
Most of the time.
It's not immoral to have fun.
Right, yeah. He wasn't like a bad dude. He wasn't a hedonist or anything. No. He wasn't known for being a drunk or...
He's just a social guy.
Just a normal sort of undergrad.
Yeah, yeah.
And quite likeable, very likeable, apparently. Mm. And there he made a lifelong friend of William Pitt, the younger.
Right.
Who, if anyone knows, was the youngest Prime Minister of all time. He was Prime Minister at like 24.
And was he the Prime Minister during the Napoleonic Wars?
Yeah. In the beginning of the Napoleonic Wars, and they were very, very, very good friends, close, best friends, really, by the end of Cambridge. And Pitt's father, the Earl of Chatham, Pitt the Elder, was a statesman. Mm. And so Pitt was always going to be in politics. No one knew he would have such a meteoric rise and be Prime Minister by the time he was 24, and Prime Minister for nearly 20 years in total and all that sort of thing, and be one of the greatest statesmen, arguably the greatest statesman of the period. But he was groomed for politics from the beginning. It's almost certainly he was going to be an MP.
Yeah.
But that wasn't what was necessarily in Wilberforce's future. Mm. But by the time they came to leave Cambridge, Wilberforce had decided, oh, maybe I should do that. Well, why not do that? Mm. I've got no other sort of great burning ambitions in life.
Yeah.
But then after uni, he went on something of a grand tour, which was something that was done in those days, very much so. He didn't go all the way to Greece or Jerusalem or anything like that, but he did France and Italy. Hmm. The main thing is Italy, really. And it was on that grand tour that he had some sort of revelation, some sort of great change. He called it a great change that came over him, where he converted to Christianity, sort of fairly hardline, moralising type Christianity.
Right.
He went with an old schoolmaster called Isaac Milner, who was one of those type Christians. Hmm. And apparently, to begin with, Wilberforce would just take the mickey out of him quite a lot for being so Christian.
Yeah.
And Milner would just say, you know, if you ever want to talk about it seriously, I'm happy to, but otherwise, you know, whatever. And eventually, for some reason, Wilberforce did sort of come round or just sort of start thinking about it seriously and then sort of realised, quite often that happens, doesn't it?
Mm.
Like a conversion on the road to Damascus type deal.
Okay.
There was a book called The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul by someone called Philip Doddridge.
Right.
Which Wilberforce had heard about. And Isaac Milner said, yeah, it's an amazing book. You should read it and we can talk about it. And they did. Because big part of the grand tour is that you take someone with you, if you can, who's a great conversationalist. That's what you really want. You don't just go on the grand tour. You also go with a good friend who's a great conversationalist. And that's what really makes it. So, yeah, there's loads of examples of that. And, yeah, so they he basically converted to a much harder line, sort of quite serious moralising form of Christianity on that grand tour. And then when he came back, he became a member of parliament quite quickly and then got a safe seat in Yorkshire eventually. And, of course, he was a Pittite. Of course, he was, you know, a follower of Pitt. And well, they were very good friends, closest of friends, really. And but he had some sort of what's the word where you a crisis of character where he didn't know what to do with his life. You know, some not everyone always ever gets there, or not until they're usually a bit older. But he had some sort of crisis, like what am I going to? What's the point of my life? What am I going to do? What am I going to strive for? And he did decide it would be about abolitionism and slavery. And he went to talk to a, someone he knew, a friend, someone called John Newton. Now, this John Newton's a fascinating character to me.
Right.
He later became a clergyman, a priest, the Reverend John Newton.
Right.
That was a bit later in his life. But he had a very, very action-packed early life, like a weirdly, some people are not black and white. They've got a checkered past and they've got a very complicated emotional life, a complicated emotional backstory.
Yeah.
And he's one of those. So when he was a young man, John Newton was taking a ship to the Americas and he was just pressed into the Royal Navy against his will.
Well, this happened a lot.
Right. And then he was flogged at one point for insubordination, you know, like quite bad injustices.
Yeah.
And then at one point he fell out with another captain on a ship. So they abandoned him in West Africa.
Thank you. I mean, at least I didn't want to be in the Navy.
And then he was enslaved.
Oh, God.
By black slavers in West Africa. He was enslaved. He became the personal slave of some black princess in West Africa.
Right. Okay.
He became her slave.
Yeah.
Eventually, he escaped and got out. But he'd known what it was like to be first impressed type of indentured slavery and then an actual slave. Then he went on to control a slave ship himself.
Okay.
And apparently he was like, when he did that, he was as humane as he could be because he sort of knew. So he'd been a slave and a slaver earlier in his life.
It was a very interesting set of circumstances.
And then became sort of, well, already, but then became sort of an arch abolitionist.
Right.
He was sort of a famous abolitionist by later in life, became a priest and everything. But yeah, what a complicated thing that is, right?
Yeah.
And so for Wilberforce, he was like, he's the guy I've got to go to and speak to about my crisis.
He knows about.
Right.
You know.
I mean, this John Newton wrote Amazing Grace, the song Amazing Grace.
Right, right, okay.
He talks about how God saved a wretch like me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Deep stuff, really, to be fair.
Yeah.
And John Newton said to Wilberforce, my God, you're like, you're a member of parliament, you're friends with Pitt. Don't give that up. Because Wilberforce was saying, I think I want to become a priest or something, become a clergyman. Yeah. Of some type. And John Newton said, you're in a potentially an incredibly powerful position. You know, being a member of parliament in the late 18th century, you're among the most powerful men in the world.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, among the most powerful cabals there's ever been, in a sense. Especially if you're friends, you've got the ear of Pitt. Use that. Don't throw that away. Use that. And so, well, he did. John Newton wrote a book called An Authentic Narrative, all about this sort of thing.
Right, okay.
Again, very powerful.
Yeah.
Pit.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Comfort is often the first thing we're willing to give up, like taking a long flight for a vacation or waking up early for a workout. But don't let style be the reason you aren't comfy. Mack Weldon's Ace Collection makes it effortless to look put together while feeling truly comfortable. Inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, the Ace Collection combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and confident looks. Upgrade your collection for the new year with new bomber jackets, half zips, sweats, crew necks, and much more. Get comfortable anywhere with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com. Promo code MACK25.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, like all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.